enjoy a good squeeze.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm Margot.
And I'm August.
And this is A Good Squeeze.
The show where we squeeze a little bit of that James Bond into our everyday lives.
That's right. And today is a very special episode, just like every episode that we record. This one's extra special.
It's extra special because we got a special guest.
We're not going to tell you.
The self-proclaimed Fraser Crane of the Bond community, the analyst himself, a Golden Bullet winner, Ryan Holt of Analyze This, Mr. Bond. Ryan, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. It is a pleasure to be here. Hello, everybody out there. I love these two people. So when they asked me to do this, I could not say no. You two are the greatest.
You're the greatest, and that's so kind of you. That's, I'm like blushing right now.
Flattery works.
It does work here, though. So.
It's gotten me everywhere.
Oh,
but we're really happy to have Ryan on the show. We were like, I don't know, of the same Bond cohort. You know, we all kind of came in around the same time. We all got nominated for that Golden Bullet, right, of Newcomer of the Year. But someone in this room won. That was that guy right there.
That's right. Well deserved. We're not bitter. Yeah. No, I'm joking.
This has all been an elaborate scheme to get me right in my office, right in view of the window. Here comes the sniper's bullet.
Yeah.
You see me with like a fishing rod and I'm off screen and then it's right there.
We invited you on the show just to embarrass you.
Oh, man.
I was so grateful for that experience because I did get to meet folks like yourself as part of it. Mm-hmm. That was so lovely. It was lovely to get the recognition, but in some ways it was lovely to just see everybody in this community who's kind of like part of it, because this community was a little stagnant, let's say, between the years of No Time to Die's release and where we're at now. And thankfully things are gearing up again. But I think a lot of folks that had come into the community had like really burnt out after, you know, their umpteenth commentary on Dr. No. So it was great to see like a whole host of people that had been kind of still at it and were looking to kind of make their mark. And you guys have been so lovely. I've always said that I did this to meet people more than anything and make friends with people like yourself. And it's been great.
We're so glad to hear that because I feel like that's something that is the biggest driver for most people's introduction into this community is I just want to be around people who like the same stuff as me, who want to talk about the same stuff as me, and just that validation that you get from people around here, the Bond community, even if you're not a Bond fan such as myself, you're still involved in these conversations. And what's so crazy about like our like relation to you is like we knew of you as like we were consuming your content. We weren't in cahoots or nothing. So like that's the thing is when we were like graced with the honor to just stand next to you for half a second as like fellow nominees, we're like, oh my God. Like it was like, I don't know. It was overwhelming. It was like, oh my gosh, like it's Analyze This, Mr. Bond, quick, act natural. Like, I don't know. It was just so cool. And then like just being able to then, you know, then do have that back and forth at like various events and under different circumstances, it's just been like so nice to see the person behind the person, not, I don't want to say persona, because you truly are so very authentic in the way that you deliver your content. And like meeting you was definitely that situation where I'm like, oh my God, like he's actually a real human being, as I suspected the whole time. You know, like you're always kind of worried when you're consuming that and you're like, oh, I hope he is that nice in person. And then you are in fact that nice in person. And you're like, oh my gosh. Okay. So the Bond community is unproblematic, like to an nth degree.
Now it's my turn to blush, but that, yes. Thank you. But I'm so surprised in some ways, you know, it's just me with my rickety camera set up over here on YouTube. It always has been. My Instagram has had a bit of a glow up since those early days, but definitely my YouTube has been and continues to be pretty lo-fi. So I am flattered. But I think that's one thing that I love about this community is just how many authentic people are at the heart of it, and how homegrown it feels, and how, you know, we're just all here, like, being ourselves, hopefully. And you guys are definitely 100% yourselves on your podcast.
That I know of.
Yeah, I mean, there are all the people you have kidnapped in your basement. I do. But we all have our side gig. So yeah. I understand.
Stop telling them about that.
We all have a well in the basement.
Yeah.
I'm actually the novice and Mark is the nostalgia. I'm
really good at kidnapping people. Just kidding, for the record. So I'm not just, you know. Here we go.
No, but you know, as Margot said, we were consuming your content. That's what drew us to you in the first place. As far as, you know, content goes, now friendship, and it's a beautiful, wonderful thing. I know. I think the first video I ever saw of yours, you were dissecting, analyzing Diamonds Are Forever. And
that one.
And then, you know, life goes on and all your other stuff. But as someone who consumes James Bond, as someone who analyzes it the way you do, my first question for you tonight is a doozy. But, you know, you treat James Bond not just as entertainment, but like as a cultural artifact. Okay. What do you think longtime fans of Bond and modern fans misunderstand the most about James Bond when they reduce him to like martinis and gadgets and one-liners? Like, what's that one thing that really stands out about Bond that maybe novices or just fans in general are not really getting into too much?
That is a fabulous question. And also, what a bell curve of a question to come out at your guest with after this like light, flattery,
yeah.
cushy opening. Ryan, what's the one thing Bond fans misunderstand about their most beloved character?
Yeah, here's a pillow. Here's a 50-pound weight. hold them both equally.
Yeah, exactly. I honestly think it's this, and I don't think it's a misunderstanding, because I think when you talk about Bond being martinis or gadgets or all the other things that he is, an assassin, all these other facets of the character, I think what sometimes gets lost, because those are just aspects of the character, is that the character is fundamentally kind of a paradox in and of himself. Like, he is both tough and hyper-masculine, but also associated with aspects of the finery of life that are typically not coded as masculine, are the kind of things that we might associate with what a quote-unquote dandyish lifestyle might be, right? He cares about the vintage of champagne. Like, that is a very fussy behavior. If somebody did that to you, they would seem very pedantic and kind of obsessive. And Bond combines a lot of contradictory aspects into one sort of fantasy character that everybody can live through vicariously. And we all gravitate, those of us who are Bond fans, gravitate towards different facets more than others. And I think that's a very interesting thing to see. But I think you have to recognize that the success of the character is kind of in embracing the tensions and the contrasts of the character, that all of these things that don't easily sit side by side together in other characters do in James Bond. And I think that's one reason the character continues to endure when there's a lot of like other tough action heroes that just kind of have their moment and fade away.
I love that. And what's nice about all the different portrayals of Bond we've gotten throughout the decades, there's a little something different for everyone, whether you're a fan of this or a fan of that. That also, I think, adds to just what people can pick out. Like, that's why we all rank these things too. Like, I gravitate more to this in my life than that. But all the items you mentioned are riddled throughout, just in different ways.
They are, and I'm just gonna get on my soapbox a little bit on this one point, because something you said triggers that. There have been a lot of very different portrayals of James Bond. One of my big pet peeves is when people talk about the Daniel Craig era and then treat all the people that came before him as though they were like one relatively consistent portrayal of James Bond. And the gulf of difference between, you know, Roger Moore in Moonraker and Timothy Dalton's James Bond is pretty stark. So these have always been pretty dynamic variations on a theme that lean into these contradictions in different ways. They all kind of pull back from the Ian Fleming source material, but they kind of, every Bond deviates in their own way, brings new colors to the character. And that's one way the character continues to feel creative and evolve, is just that every actor that comes into it is able to, let's say, like, it's 60% Bond the character and like 40% new stuff, in a way that shines a light on the rest of it and kind of continues to open the door to new possibilities as the character evolves.
Yeah. Do you think, Margo, Roger Moore is the fussiest of the Bond portrayals?
I can't tell you. I can't say that yet. I was actually going to ask you too, as nostalgics, the idea of, like, how did you phrase it in the first question? Like, what it is that
people misunderstand the most about the character?
Is this something that you guys were aware of while you were growing up watching these movies? Is this something that, like, while you're watching this, you're like, oh, this is a flawed individual because XYZ? Or is this something, like, you meet when you're, like, talking about how much you love Bond and then somebody presents that idea to you? Is this something that is just, like, inherent in the character that you almost appreciate as a flaw, or is it just kind of like a pop culture difference of opinion?
So what do you mean by flaws in particular? Are you talking like his moral defects?
Sean Connery being like, you should hit a woman with a closed fist, like that kind of stuff. Now, not saying that you were into it. No, we're not. We're saying no to that.
Well, that wasn't Bond.
But you know what I mean? Like, it's that idea of, like, the stuff that, I don't want to call it a flaw, like what was written in to make the character more complex, but like the different interpretations, there are certain things that draw people in with Bond and there's certain things that push people away from Bond.
Sure.
Are those things that you even registered while you were consuming this? Just, you know, when you love something, you love something. Or was this something that was, like, presented to you as, like, a counter? I don't know if I'm phrasing this.
It might be helpful to explain how I got to see Bond to understand my perspective on that. Because I think a lot of people come to James Bond in their childhood, right? Mm-hmm. And I certainly wouldn't have been watching these movies as an 11-year-old with a nuanced understanding of race and gender politics and how the past decades of Bond played into those dynamics.
Okay.
But I was raised in a homeschooled evangelical Christian childhood. My father loved James Bond. My mom kind of treated James Bond like contraband, right? Like, this was something that was kind of illicit. And yes, Ryan can see it if my dad will show it commit to showing it to you and fast forwarding through the really sexy bits, and that added to the appeal, not detract from it. It was always very clear that Bond was not a quote unquote good person, and that these movies were kind of not in the framework that I was raised in any way, like, good and proper. I mean, these movies were condemned by the Catholic Church when Sean Connery first appeared as Dr. No, right? So it's not
really?
So yeah. Oh, for the violence and the sexuality behavior. This character has always existed in, like, counterpoint to social mores. Like, he is not a good person per se, but that's why he's attractive, right? He's kind of got the excitement of, like, oh, like he's beyond the pale a little bit. And especially in the Sean Connery incarnation, the Ian Fleming version of the character is a little bit more human and a little bit less aggressive in this. But Connery kind of comes in and brings this, like, swagger that is the fantasy figure of all these Playboy reading suburban dads who are, like, trapped in their 1960s existence and just want to be the most, like tough, virile guys that you can imagine and escape the doldrums of their day. And so the character is kind of outrageous. Like, even if you're reading film critic reviews of Goldfinger from when that came out in 1964. Like, you have film critic Pauline Kael writing that, like, the sexism of Goldfinger in 1964 was so outrageous for 1964 that you can't help but take it as anything other than a joke and enjoy it for that, right? So it was very much always this kind of counterpoint and this figure that is, like, so extreme that part of the fun is just in seeing the extremes. And I think that is somewhat inherent to the appeal of pulp in general. Pulp is not always as aware of what's going on in it, but pulp is kind of in its play to desires that are maybe not what we might call like savory per se, but are still part of our inner makeup. It kind of tends to open up the psyche a little bit. And I think James Bond as fantasy character does that fundamentally. And then because of that, you kind of get all the other stuff that just happens with stuff being a movie of its time and the cultural blind spots of a certain era and how this figure plays into those cultural blind spots is very different. And was I aware of all those aspects? No, but I was also aware of, like, Bond probably shouldn't hit a woman. Like, that kind of discomfort was always there. But, you know, my affection for the character and kind of this uniquely exuberant figure for which there is no real substitute. I think that's the thing about James Bond. Like, if you take James Bond off the table, there isn't, like, somebody waiting in the wings that's like, oh yeah, here's James Bond, but, like, without all the baggage of James Bond, and it's great. In part, some of what makes James Bond great is all those rough edges, that you can go watch a 1973 James Bond film, and it is like, oh man, what were they doing in 1973? But in some ways, it more accurately captures what the culture of 1973 was than the movies that you might look at and be like, oh, that's held up seamlessly. It hasn't aged a day. The fact that Bond captures some of that is actually part of its power as an object and part of the pleasure of going back to it. It's actually very honest about what 1973 was and what audiences enjoyed in 1973 to go back and watch Live and Let Die.
There's, like, little spicy time capsules, as we like to refer to them as.
I mean, that answered my question flawlessly, truly. I mean, and I gave an extreme example, obviously. First thing that pops into my head, and that was, like, when my first introduction to James Bond was learning all of those little, you know, nuances that were, I don't know, it just tugs at, like, some difficult conversations and all that. And so I was curious, like, I never even thought of the idea of, like, okay, if you did grow up in a religious household, what was it that, you know, you had to fast forward versus being, like, growing up in, like, a predominantly female household versus growing up in a predominantly male household? And I feel like that interpretation, it didn't even cross my mind. What was I going to say? Yeah, well, that answers my question. Thank you. Yeah. Sorry.
Kind of in a similar vein, I grew up in a very, very Catholic household, and I was not allowed to watch anything beyond a PG without parental supervision, that's for sure. And there are many times watching those Pierce Brosnan era movies with not a fast forward, but a pillow over the face. Like, Xenia, any scene with Xenia, I was getting my eyes covered. Even at the beginning of Tomorrow Never Dies, when Bond's, like, mowing down all those villains, pillow over the eyes, just because it was so violent. But I was allowed to watch them to a degree. And for myself, it was that, like, forbidden fruit, you know, that kind of escapism. Like, I knew it was bad. I knew you're not supposed to do that, but it was so exciting to get to see, like, peek behind the curtain. Like, I'm not supposed to see this, but I am. And escapism in general is, like, what makes Bond so exciting and what keeps me coming back for more, obviously. But with what you were saying, I feel like all the added layer beyond that is, like, a learned behavior, you know, that came with years of consuming and being exposed to, whether it's an analyst like Ryan or a documentary or even reading the books, you learn more of this, like, very, very rounded character.
Sure. And I mean, that's something that I never, I mean, any, I don't know, I feel like individual would worry when you're like, I don't know, when you're playing a lot of violent video games, or if you're consuming a certain type of media, the first fear for any parent, guardian, or even just spouse or partner or whatever is like, are they going to be picking up these behaviors? Mm. But then it's understanding the intention. It's not like Bond is saying like, you should be doing this. Like, obviously, again, I gave a very extreme example. Not definitely not accusing the fandom or just the actual, what do you call it? The franchise. Sorry, that was the word. The franchise of promoting anything like that. It's mostly just the idea of like, it is peppered in here and there. And it's really interesting to see how that's interpreted. But at the end of the day, it's not being interpreted in any way other than like exactly what you guys said, which is take a look at what was going on there. Like, it is a pop culture sponge, these movies. It's just like, what's going on, what's relevant in the time, soaking it up, and let's take a creative spin at it. And it's interesting seeing that as a novice, because that is something I had to learn. Because again, like, compared to, you know, your guys' introduction was when you were younger, so there wasn't that like, oh, I'm hyper aware of every political thing that's going on. I started watching it during the pandemic, yeah. Right? Therefore, hyper aware of everything that was going on. And
we watched Live and Let Die.
And we watched Live and Let Die. And I was I jumped on my soapbox. I said, this isn't right. You know, I threw my tantrum. It was great. And so from my perspective, it was definitely, this is sending these messages of XYZ. But because I hadn't watched it from that perspective of just pure enjoyment, pure entertainment, I've never thought of it in that perspective. I can't just shut my brain off, and I haven't shut my brain off, but like rewire it to consume it in that fashion. So it's really interesting hearing that perspective of not just you guys as Bond fans now, but what it was like consuming that as a younger person growing up in certain circumstances. I'm really interested to see what that looks like for other people's circumstances. Like, what was it like in a more atheist household? Was it, again, like I said, like predominantly female, predominantly male? Mm-hmm. You know, when we're talking about socioeconomic background, how did that play a factor into that? Yeah, we will do a case study. We will get back to you on that. And yeah.
Sorry, I like your case study, Mr. Bond. Yeah, no, I think that it's very interesting the way people connect with this character. One thing I would ask, Margot, is before you were introduced to the Bond series, did you have a lot of experience with retro cinema in general? Like, were you raised watching films of the 1960s, 50s, 40s, and so on?
Yes, very much so. My parents are big cinephiles. A big thing that I was, because we're a European family, like, we watched a lot of movies. Like, my parents were like, oh, you should watch Black Cat, White Cat. It is a 1980s Serbian movie about a marriage gone wrong. You know, so it's like stuff like that that I was watching a lot of. It wasn't until like later in high school, no, early college, that my family started really digging American movies, particularly rom-coms. But before that, it was a lot of vintage cinema, however you want to call that. Like, so we did grow up with that. That is something I did appreciate, but we never touched any kind of major franchise. My parents were never into that kind of stuff. So
it was more like art drama kind of.
Yeah, either whatever. That or like this hilarious Norwegian comedy, you know, from like 1954, like stuff like that. Yeah. And I'm like 8, mind you, when they're showing me this, and they're like, didn't you like that movie? And I'm like, of course I did. I'm 8 years old. Like, I love subtitles. But now I'm a snob and I love it. That's the thing. I'm like, oh, you haven't seen Black Cat, White Cat? That's yeah tragic. Yeah. But yeah, so I did grow up with that, but not in that fashion, though. Yeah. So
it was either like Serbian dramas or like French dub Disney films. It wasn't really like pew pew action movies or sci-fi.
Even
or
to like this that. Day, like, I'll be watching something and I'll be like, this is too violent for me. Like, I don't know. It just, it'll, what movie? We were watching a Bond film. It was a Timothy Dalton one. The one
License to Kill.
Yeah, I looked at you. I said, "This is too violent for me. I don't think I'm allowed to watch this." Like,
but not a horror fan, Margot, I take it.
Oh no, unfortunately not. The stories. I will read the Wikipedia synopsis. I love doing that stuff. I love knowing. Like, I know what Rosemary's Baby is about. I know Children of the Corn. I love that story as a tale and as written out in like 5 paragraphs. I can't watch it. Just because I, you know, at the end of the day, when it's nighttime and I have to turn off all the lights, I'm like, run into my bed, jump in like a ninja type stuff. Like, I can't do it. Too scary.
Yeah.
I'm
a big horror buff. I'm a big horror buff. And I think the horror, my appetite for horror and my appetite for James Bond kind of coexist in different lanes. I have this appetite inside me that is always interested in like forbidden knowledge, right? The forbidden is appealing. And because I don't particularly love gore, I don't love like slasher films for that reason, but I love this idea of like art or storytelling as a gate to something primal and a little bit unfathomable. And I think James Bond had that, especially when you're young, right? James Bond is this gateway to adulthood, right? There's something, especially with the way that the character kind of leans into sensuality in a way that is tremendously uncommon for any other series. Somehow James Bond became a family series, right? We're all going to go see James Bond. And it feels like you're kind of like encountering the gateway to like some sort of like adult secret, especially when you're an adolescent. And it's almost, especially in the way that James Bond tends to be like a generational handoff in a lot of places, not for everybody, but it was for me very much, where it was like my father and I were able to connect and share James Bond movies. It's kind of like this like handshake into adulthood, particularly guyhood. I think James Bond is not exclusively for men, but is generally a masculine geared fantasy in the same way that the romanticy genre now is exclusively like targeted towards a female reader base, even though I know I have friends of mine who are guys who are devouring Avatar. That kind of thing, it gives it a little bit of, as when you're young, like this, oh, this is a kind of like a secret of the world kind of appeal to it. And that is something I chase in all art a little bit.
That's very interesting, because that actually explains a lot. I'm like thinking of myself now. I'm like, let's make this about me. talking about like the whole like risque, this is not allowed, this and that. Again, I grew up in a very European household. We grew up atheist, so we didn't, it was very blasé, whatever. They always told us, just be very respectful of other people's religions, but do whatever you want. So with that came a lot of, we didn't have a lot of censorship. My parents, the conversation of sex, that was just something that was thrown around since I was a kid. Like, that just didn't faze us too much. My parents showed us a lot of like war films, and like not the fun kind, you know? So like, we weren't that kind of violence and all that. They were very, like, very adamant about telling us, like, this is the reality of the world. Like, so I do have, like, a fascination for the morose. I mean, honestly, we have so much taxidermy. I'm looking at one taxidermied weasel here, and I have all my baby teeth in a container on my desk right now. So, see what I mean? Like, it's there, but it's not there. And when it comes to consuming media, I do have that mental block. And I don't, that fascination isn't quite there for me when it's like that visual representation. I don't know what it is. It is like fear. It's based in fear. Like, I get very nervous when there's too much like action on like, you know, on a screen. I cannot sleep for weeks on end if I watch a scary movie. I've had friends try to trick me into watching a scary movie, and I didn't appreciate that because they thought, oh, this isn't going to hurt. I'm like, it's going to hurt for like 2 months. So don't do that. So it's interesting that whole, for the forbidden fruit, I love the word you use, like the forbidden, like that absolutely is going to draw you to something. When you tell a kid, don't touch that, they hear touch that, and they do. And that's in us into adulthood. That's just inherent in human behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. The fixation on the taboo is big. And I think that's a big part of Bond. And I think that's a big part of what we could call like pulp storytelling or just genre storytelling in general. The reverse of it, I've already brought this up, but like romance novels do the same kind of things just from very different vantage points and very different subject matter in this way that they are kind of broaching what is like a little bit forbidden or out of touch in everyday life and creating kind of absurd scenarios by which that can play out. I I think we have a malnourished vocabulary to discuss fantasy in art. And fantasy, I don't mean fantasy as in Lord of the Rings, but I just mean like fantasy as escapist fantasy. Like I have an interest in just kind of seeing this thing playing out in like an imaginative safe space. I think we have a very malnourished vocabulary for talking about what that means in art. And I don't think that malnourishment falls on any sort of political spectrum. There is this kind of weird phobia with like, if you engage with this content, it will infect you like a virus. And we have not ever really seen that happen with fictional media. We've seen that definitely happen with like a kind of like social media memification in a way that is interesting. But this kind of ability to, like, I am nothing like James Bond. I have nothing, no sense of James Bond's moral compass. I am a pacifist. I do not like firearms. I don't, you know, like, I am not a risk-seeking person. I would, you know, like, there is so much of my life that is not even about James Bond or how I would live my life or how I would recommend other people live my life. But there is such a clear psychological bifurcation between my love of that character and my sense of who I am and the ability to kind of bounce between the two. I don't think we do a good job of raising people to use cognitive dissonance as a skill. I think that is actually one of the biggest things that...
Could you define cognitive dissonance for me? I'm not smart enough for that one. I'm so sorry.
So cognitive dissonance is when you feel the tension between something being real and unreal at the same time. Like in a movie would present a great way to do it is like a great cognitive dissonance moment is like when you are become acutely aware that you're watching a movie while watching a movie. It's anti-immersion, right? Oh. Like you are seated recognizing I am a person watching this movie. Roger Moore movies do this all the time. There's a Tarzan yell. It takes you out of the movie, right? People complain about it all the time because it takes you out of the movie. I was immersed. I was feeling the immersion of the movie. I'm yanked out of it. Cognitive dissonance is that sense of like discomfort about being like kind of enmeshed in something and also knowing it's kind of like an artificial construct. And okay. I think cognitive dissonance can be a bad, like people can use cognitive dissonance to describe an uncomfortable scenario. Like this work fails because it invites cognitive dissonance. But I think cognitive dissonance is also just like an active way of living in the world. And I think that comes in, you've described me as the analyst persona. I've kind of adopted that for myself. But I think that is an important part of looking at the world analytically is just actively curating that sort of cognitive dissonance. When you're taking in an experience, simultaneously trying to understand it. I'm actually very suspicious of like immersion in the way that people are. Some people don't like spoilers. They just want to like go in and just have a movie like wash over them and not be themselves in it. And I really want to like always be the person and kind of straddle the fence. I want movies that are going to be big and grand and aesthetic and kind of beautiful and overwhelming and simultaneously be like, no, this is an object that was created by a person and this is an edit and you could see that this was a 5 second to this second shot and that's exactly what they're communicating here and parsing it simultaneously. I think you can do that same kind of principle with how you engage with imaginative fantasy in that way. And I think we do a very bad job of teaching it because we don't really have a good vocabulary for it. We don't have a good vocabulary and a good space for talking about the way the human makeup of longing and desire and psychology does not break it down into moral categories. Morality may exist, but it's kind of like a superimposition on like who the human animal actually is. We're animals, you can kind of like fit us into boxes, but like our animal nature is always going to be there lurking under the surface. And I think we have a very bad way of parsing that out as that relates to our imaginative storytelling efforts across a variety of genres.
What do you think's missing in that sense? Or how do we end up finding out? How do you find out what's missing in that?
What do you mean by that?
Well, you were talking about how we fail to have a vocabulary for that. How do we find out what it is, like the message that we're trying to communicate? How do we formulate that? And how do we find out if we haven't even really put any thought into it? If that is the case, how do we get to that conclusion?
Or at least on the way to finding
that. How do we work together?
How do we work together to develop that vocabulary?
Yeah.
I think in conversations like this, right? I think in conversations like this, in creative constructs and conversations with like people about this media, I think it's also people fear the unknown. So I think it's also about immersion, right? I think it's a lot harder to fear the unknown when the known is known. So like Bond is just one symptom of it. But this is a bias of mine because I just have always had a voracious hunger for all things culture. Like, I think the best way to not fear culture, past or present, is just to like drown yourself in it. Like just drink from it like a water hose. And some of it's going to be great and some of it's going to be ugly and some of it is going to be really interesting. And to do that and start doing the work of kind of understanding it and trying with all of it to take the humility and perspective of curiosity about all of it rather than judgment. I think criticism is more about curiosity than judgment. If you think criticism is about assessing anything or determining its validity, I think you have not understood what art criticism is. Like when you go to watch a movie, it's like studying a panther as like for a nature documentary. You're just trying to understand what it is, what makes it work, and why it exists. And then from there, you can try to start charting out where it fits in this broader world of ours where many species exist. But you kind of just need to start from places of curiosity about everything and curiosity about yourself as well as to art in that way. So
I have a friend, I don't want to say he's the opposite of curious. If it's a show, well, I'll just stick with the example of shows. If there's a show, he starts and he likes it and he's going to watch episode two, he will look up how the show ends. If it's 5 seasons long, 8 seasons, he wants to know where it goes to see, like, do the characters I like live? Does the story pan out the way I would like? Is this something that ultimately lines up with, like, you know, who I am, essentially? Will I keep watching? So he'll look up a spoiler for even movies too, but I just use shows as an example.
Yeah.
He spoils himself. He'll watch leaks of trailers and read, you know, manga leaks from Japan early just because he needs to know before it actually happens. It's a weird, interesting psychological thing he's putting himself through.
It is a huge comfort thing for him because he does not like the unexpected. A lot of things have happened to him in his life that were unexpected, and we'll leave it at that. And in media, he doesn't like seeing that reflected. He almost doesn't like seeing himself, his story, in any form of entertainment. Because for him, it's not entertaining. So anything that has to do with immersing he finds comfort in a cognitive dissonance. Is that what it was called? Right. Okay. Like he doesn't want to feel immersed. He watches everything at 1.5 speed. And here's the thing: on paper, it looks like he's just a social media guy, total brain rot, this and that. It's not that at all. It's so much more complicated than that from a psychological perspective. He truly finds comfort in predictability and consistency. And when a lot of the shows and movies that we watch, that creativity is the part of that is giving your audience something unexpected, something that, I don't know, like keeps them on their toes, not even keeps them on their toes, but like something to think about. He does not like that. And there's not a single show on this planet that doesn't have that. So everything that he consumes, it's so funny. He'll listen to this. He'll be like, why did you guys talk about me? I'll be like, because you're an interesting case study. it is absolutely fascinating that he's like a prime example of someone who does not want to be immersed. He doesn't want to have that for other reasons. Sorry, I interrupted you. I was like, let me tell the story. But yeah.
That's
but okay. But I think what you've highlighted there, Margot, that's interesting, is how we engage with art and what we take away from it is very much a reflection of ourselves. So to engage with a character like James Bond that has such a complex history, I think you have to have like a firm understanding of yourself to understand like what draws you to the character and what isn't. And I think engaging with art is like engaging with people. It's like in a marriage, right? When you show up for another person, you have to be pretty secure in yourself to be a good partner for somebody else. To engage with art, you also kind of have to go into art having a pretty secure, independent understanding of yourself and understanding what you need to take, what you need to leave, what you enjoy, why you enjoy it. And I think once you start to really explore those things in a healthy way, it's easy to celebrate a character like James Bond. I think he's one of the coolest characters. I love this film series to death. I've dedicated so many hours of my life to talking about James Bond. And, you know, you look around the fan community, you've met many of the same people I have. These are all like nice people. These are not people who are out here trying to be assassins right? These are just people who really find this kind of character and his adventures fascinating and colorful and compelling, and love those kind of contradictions. They love that sort of way that it can open up new doors to the world for them. And I think that's worth cherishing. Every once in a while, you get the year where it's like the think piece of like, should we let James Bond finally die this year, or let the series die? He's like a dinosaur out of step with the culture. And I think what people misunderstand about that is it's not really up to any of us to declare what fiction lives or dies. Fiction and culture will always follow its own course, but to be curious and generous about why things may thrive in a cultural sense. Culture is not manufactured. It's all lightning in a bottle. And so if something has struck, there's something there, and it's up to you to understand it. You don't have to like it, but you should at least understand it. I interrupted you there, August, though, just to get on my soapbox again. So what were you going to?
That was a beautiful way to bring it back to what people misunderstand the most about Bond. That was question number one.
Oh, whoops. Folks. Sorry.
But it was a heavy one. Now, let me give you a light one. Here's the pillow back. You know, with all that in mind, though, if someone is coming into James Bond fresh, in your opinion, what is the best way to get into Bond? You know, yourself, you analyze the films, the books, the clothing, the lifestyle, things like that. Is the best way to introduce someone into Bond through the fashion? Is it through the books? Is it through the films? In your opinion, what is the best way to get someone fresh into Bond?
The provocateur in me wants to give you a good, strong answer where I fall on this. But I honestly think there is no good door. It's whichever door you find to James Bond is the right door. If you talk to any horde of James Bond fans, we all came to Bond different ways. Some of us played a video game first and thought that was the cool way to get into this character, right? So many of us played a Nintendo 64 video game that had a, like, 32-bit version of Pierce Brosnan's face plastered on what looks like a rectangular, like rectangular 3D nightmare today, and said that guy looks cool, and then, you know, dug into the series. Some people went and saw like any one of the movies or read the books first. There's no formula for it. And there's no formula for what clicks. You can't pick the right movie off the shelf for your friend, as much as I've tried. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but you can't engineer it either. Sometimes it clicks, sometimes it doesn't. I think if you're trying to understand Bond, that's a different question. If you're trying to connect with Bond and become like, what is going to convert me, like a Paul on the Road to Damascus experience between being a Bond fan and not being a Bond fan, that there is no way to engineer that. That is an organic phenomenon for all of us. If you're trying to understand James Bond as a film phenomenon historically, you really do have to just go back to like Goldfinger, really, because Goldfinger was the reason the series exists today. You had two very successful movies before it, but it could have very easily petered out after a third or fourth installment. The monumental cultural zeitgeist moment that Goldfinger was is why we still are looking forward to a new Bond movie today. It was that weird, raw energy of Sean Connery being at the peak of his powers is this character with all the complexity of that and all the absurdity of it and glamour of it and also horror of it. I mean, the title image of it is a woman who has been suffocated to death in gold paint. It haunted me as a child. I was terrified of it, but it's this fascinating image. Goldfinger is really, you know, is the movie, as much as I don't like count it as one of my very tip-top favorites, it's the magnum cultural artifact of the series.
Yeah, it is certainly on the Mount Rushmore, whether you feel like it's in your top four or not. Its cultural significance is certainly there. It's funny you said that about the Jill Masterson, you know, the Golden Girl. Growing up, I was told, like, I don't know, not the folklore, but whatever, that she died, that actress died during that scene, and they filmed it. Like, I was told that at a very young age. So I was afraid of that, too. I was afraid of that, too. Him, or her and Tin Man, I was always told they died because they were painted and they had skin suffocation. Anyway.
Tin Man, I think, if I recall correctly, I thought I saw some trivia come up during Wicked that guy did have issues because of the paint that they used later in life, because it was like a poisonous metallic, like lead paint or something like that. Mm-hmm. That was not
ideal. I know the original Tin Man, who was not, I apologize, I don't know the name of the actor who we do get, but the original got very ill because he had an allergic reaction and he was just covered in that stuff. And I don't know if he's the trivia fact that we're thinking of, where he, like, later on in life became very ill because of it. Yeah. But yeah, that's what I grew up with. But yeah, I agree with you. Like, if you have to pick like a route to get someone fresh eyes into what James Bond is, Goldfinger might be the answer. And, you know, here on A Good Squeeze, that's like kind of the shtick. Like, how do you introduce the novice to James mm-hmm. Bond? And there is no answer. Even our answer is like no answer. It's the journey along the way.
Well, it's also the answer would be like, who are you introducing this to?
Sure. Absolutely.
Like, how well do you know this person? Are you doing like a mass audience thing? Like, is it, you know, what are all the various circumstances? But I feel like there is definitely, like, amongst the nostalgics, like, there's that, like, well, hold on, give me a chance, I'm gonna set the mood, I'm gonna put on my this movie, insert movie right here, that is like your go-to for like everybody I've shown this movie to always likes it, ba ba ba, this is my introduction to Bond. Like, so what would be your, like, let me set the mood kind of thing?
So It's interesting because you have met my fiance Mackenzie. In fact, you said hello to her right before we started recording this. Mm-hmm. And I had to introduce her to James Bond because she's not really a big Bond. She'd seen, you know, some of the Daniel Craig movies, but she hadn't seen my favorites. And obviously, I have a social media project called Analyze This Mr. Bond, so she's very interested in it. And my attempts to choose something that I thought would align with her didn't quite work. What worked was just saying, this is like a way to understand me. It's not me trying to sell you on something, right? I want to share something with you that, like, this is the one that I really connect with, and here's why. And then, you know, kind of watching those movies hit pretty well. And so for me, it's always going to be my favorite Bond movie, For that reason. And generally, this movie goes over pretty well with people who have never seen a Bond movie before or have only seen a few, is You Only Live Twice, which is just a bonanza 1960s to the max spectacle that doesn't really encapsulate everything about the Bond character per se that people love, but captures this wonderful dreamlike quality that the Bond movies can have, where they are just can be so grand and so absurd and so strange on a large widescreen canvas. And she's quite enjoyed You Only Live Twice. In general, she gravitated more towards the Sean Connery films than the Daniel Craig films. She doesn't really like Daniel Craig's action-heavy James Bond. She likes the raw charm of a prime Sean Connery, and who can blame her? He really is quite a presence in those movies.
Shakshi, as I say. Yeah. For sure. Now, there is something about Sean Connery and the aura he brings, certainly, but You Only Live Twice, it's just so like whimsical without that kind of fantasy, right? It's a beautiful, sweeping just experience. I have said too with You Only Live Twice, in a kind of in a spin way, in a modern time, a lot of maybe certain people, they might have seen like an Austin Powers movie.
Yeah.
And have never seen a James Bond movie. They might connect with You Only Live Twice because so many spoofs and things are drawn from You Only Live Twice that they could connect to it in that way.
It's yeah.
Good movie.
It is. It's I've said this before in defense of You Only Live Twice. It's you could argue that more than the other Connery movies, it kind of established the visual vocabulary of what people parody when they think of a James Bond movie, like the volcano lair and all this kind of spectacle about it. It pushes that language so far visually that it kind of embedded it in the cultural consciousness. And it's no surprise that Austin Powers picked up and ran with it when we got to those fun movies that I also grew up with around the same time that I was falling in love with James Bond. I kind of jumped back and forth between Austin Powers and James Bond in a way that I really enjoyed.
Of course.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, what's also very valuable about the experience that you were able to share with her is like, you showed her a movie, yes, but it wasn't. I feel like sometimes when you meet someone and they like you for who you are, so if you're going to show them something not that you think they will like, but something that is just like you said, like if it's a piece of you, they're so much more likely to like it than if you show them something you think that they're going to like, et cetera, et cetera. Like when you showed me You Only Live Twice, no, Live and Let Die. There's a lot of L's, sorry. Live and Let Die. Versus GoldenEye, yes, there's definitely that piece of like what I would prefer, what I wouldn't, but GoldenEye is your favorite one, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like there is also meaning there. Like, I didn't know it was your favorite, but somehow that was the one that was
expressed that, yeah, you would have.
But even without expressing it, it was just like, yeah, this feels right. This is a good movie. I don't know. It's just like when you know, and if I didn't like you, I would have been like, I hate this. I'm leaving, you know, but like, I feel like there's something really valuable in like exactly what you said, Ryan, like showing somebody a piece of you. It's like, I like this for a reason and you like me for a reason. Therefore, you should like this too. You know, like it's the associative property.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, from the novels to, you know, that Sean Connery era to, you know, the Casino Royale reboot. What do you think in like the Bond mythos has been the most like culturally significant through like what turn has been like the most impactful as far as Bond and culture?
Yeah, I really don't think you can do stronger than casting Connery as Fleming's James Bond because Connery was regarded by many as miscast originally when he was selected for the role of James Bond. And you have to remember, James Bond was originally modeled on Ian Fleming himself. He's, if you've listened to recordings of Ian Fleming speak, he's kind of like this posh, upper crust English guy. And that was kind of the model that James Bond was going to be. Ian Fleming wanted people like David Niven or Cary Grant. And people love Cary Grant, but Cary Grant does feel very upper class. And what Connery brings to the role, because he is such a working class Scotsman, is this sort of everyman-ish quality that sits alongside what are sometimes aristocratic tendencies of the James Bond character, and made the character kind of accessible to the masses in a way that I don't think it would have been if you had cast somebody who was more in the classic Fleming Bond mold at that time. It was kind of like, it made the character, again, I talk about the contradictions of this character. Bond becomes weirdly kind of classless because you cast Sean Connery's Bond. He's this kind of paradox of this like tough Scot living this upper crust English lifestyle. And it kind of comes off different. It comes off very differently when Sean Connery is fussy about champagne than it does when you get Roger Moore like a decade or so later. There's a reason that Roger Moore's Bond is treated more as like a parody of like English fussiness in a little bit of a way that it isn't for Connery. And I don't think the series had ever made a different casting call that it would have ever been as significant. Now, because that feels like a boring answer, because Connery just is like, that's Dr. No. It's the start of the film series. You're saying that's the most significant pivot. I would say the second most significant pivot after that is probably, I mean, this is tough, but probably casting Daniel Craig as James Bond. I don't think people know how close the series was to kind of evaporating a little bit over the course of the 90s, especially we had that long, it doesn't feel now like a super long delay compared to how long we waited for Bond movie right now, but between License to Kill and GoldenEye, and that sort of real hostility on part of the studio as to whether Bond was even like relevant anymore. There was real skepticism about it. And I think Bond was in danger of just becoming yet another like studio product by the time you get to Die Another Day, with the heavy hand that was being laid and pressure on what the series was to be. And when you have Daniel Craig come around, it makes the character feel less like this kind of, and I like Pierce Brosnan's Bond more than I like as a personal like affinity, more than I necessarily like Craig's Bond. But I feel like Craig made the character vital and current in a way that Bond hadn't really been in quite some time.
I agree. You know, there's so many people of, you know, of our generation who Daniel Craig was their in with James Bond, because it was, you know, such a phenomenon, especially by the time you get to Skyfall. It was huge. But I know people now who that's the only Bond they've ever seen. And, you know, it's fascinating to hear that they didn't go back beyond that. It was just Craig like brought it into their lives and kept it alive, and that's where they leave it. I mean, I think that was not necessarily you, but like when we, before we ever made the show, you know, I'm showing her James Bond movies, and it was the Craig movies that we watched all five of them.
Yeah.
Boop, ba doop, ba doop.
Yep.
But I would add, like, as like a cultural significance, like a big one, I would say is Bond in video games. Certainly,
yeah.
Certainly GoldenEye. Because, you know, how many thousands have you heard that's how they got into Bond? I'm that guy for sure. But I think it's going to happen again with First Light coming out. And I know you've spoken on this in depth, yeah. But it's going to be huge. And I think it could be like another resurgence that we're not even expecting. Like, we know it's going to be big, but we might not really realize the cultural significance.
Yeah, the caveat being that the game has to be good, right? There are a lot of hyped games that come out and are a little bit lukewarm, right? But people are really anticipating First Light. I'm all in on it. And I I really do think that video games are culturally significant. I understand the kind of ambivalence in the larger Bond community about this, because it's the first time there's kind of like a medium break in there. It's a medium that has a bit of a generational divide around it. So it's not like James Bond, the cinematic object, can be something you gather the whole family around to watch a Bond movie. A video game is not quite a communal experience in that way. Video games can be very communal, but it is not like, let's gather mom and dad and nephew John in front of the TV here after Thanksgiving to watch me play 007 First Light. It's not that experience.
I am inclined to interject here for surprise, surprise. Morgan wants to interrupt. I will say it is becoming more and more popular. And this is, as my time as a preschool teacher, this is something that we would hear about frequently. And it's not mainstream enough to be like such a foundation in certain children's development, but it's becoming so much more common for kids to sit down with their parents while their parents play video games. Just as like when your parents are watching TV, you would just sit and aimlessly, just because that's what's on. That's what they're watching. They got the remote. You're not going to, God forbid, you say, I want to watch something, because that's not allowed. There were so many children, I want to say in the teens, like tens, whatever. Yeah. Of kids who would, like, you know, you would ask like, oh, what did you do this weekend? They're like, I watched Spider-Man. And the parents tell me like, oh, that's just their dad playing the Spider-Man video game. And then they just watch. It's becoming more common. Now, I don't want to say it's like fully a pop culture thing, but that is something that the current like Gen Alpha is going to be growing up with a lot more. Anyways, just a side tangent. But yes, sorry. As you were saying.
No, I think that's an astute observation, because I think what you are seeing is kids more and more across the gender spectrum. It's not, it is not just the stereotype was like, it's only little boys who go and play Nintendo 64. Girls want nothing to do with it. That's how it felt when I grew up, like video games are for boys. The advertising was that way. It's not that way anymore at all. And the audience for video games is so huge among the, let's say, you know, I'm millennial, but like the generations that came after me in particular, a lot of millennials are gaming, but a lot of my peers, I got to admit, a lot of my peers have kind of like fallen off the gaming wagon. They gamed up through college and they kind of like mothballed the gaming system and moved on to family life. But beneath that, I think you're just seeing it like it's a staple of the home. And that is changing the home dynamic. And that makes this game in particular a particularly critical one for what is coming about this character in the future. We're very clearly, I don't want to be too cynical about it, but like cinema has peaked in terms of cultural influence. We're all excited about the next Bond film because we love movies. I love movies, but like cinema's time is maybe not done, but like cinema is no longer, even right now, at the fulcrum of culture the way it was, 30 years ago. So it is really critical that they get this digital version of the character right if they want the character to continue to have a legacy there. And I really hope it does. I'm really excited to see what it does. And I think it looks like they're doing some really smart things with it. So I'm excited.
Me too.
It's going to be interesting to see, because I know that, I mean, okay, so this is kind of a tangent, but it is relevant, I swear. We just started playing Dungeons and Dragons. And as soon as we started telling people that, they recommended, I don't play video games, so he does, the Dungeons and Dragons game. What is it called?
Baldur's Gate.
Yes. and it's interesting because in our generation, millennials, like it is so much more common for, you say you're getting into something, they have a video game. Like it's like, it just happens so quickly for some people. So I'm interested to see how this video game, you're playing it, your kid watches you play it. And I don't think that's a bad thing at all. I think that's a wonderful quality time with your kids, sharing with them what it is that you're interested in, answering their questions as you're playing, or just spending time with them is, I think, wonderful. But it'll be really interesting how, like, you know, our generation of Bond fans was the video game, the, and what is it, N64? And then prior to that, it was like my grandpa or my dad showed it to me, this next generation is going to be like, oh, watching my dad play the video game. Like that's, yeah, that's going to be an interesting conversation. And I feel like that's going to be a really interesting way of like, how are they going to introduce their partners, their friends to Bond? Is it going to be through the video game? Is it going to be through the movies? Is it going to be through the books? And I feel like that idea of the video game might climb a lot higher mm-hmm. down the line, just because it is such a common vernacular for our generation, but it is, it's like we don't even really think about it. Like my, you yeah. know, like our parents' generation, they weren't like, oh, you should check out this board game. Like, you know, it was like, you know, and they didn't grow up with video games. That's why I said board games. I don't want to make them sound ancient or anything, but you know, yeah, like it's so much more common.
Maybe there'll be
a
generation that's like, I got introduced to Bond from A Good Squeeze.
Yeah. I watched my parents' podcast. Like, yeah. That would be nuts.
I learned from James Bond, or about James Bond, from Analyze This, Mr. Bond.
Yeah.
I have two little fun questions for you. Okay. To wrap it up. Keeping it light. This one doesn't have to be heavy. It's going to sound heavy, but please don't feel like it needs to be unless you want it to be. You take James Bond and you squeeze him into one little thing. What if you're to sum up James Bond into a scene, a yeah. piece of music, a line, anything? If you had to sum up James Bond and what's made him endure throughout the 70 plus year history, what is like, that's James Bond, and you're showing it to somebody like, this is James Bond, boop, and that's it, just for fun. So
just one thing.
Just one thing. Just for fun. It's a doozy.
That's a hard one. How small does the thing have to be? Do I get like 5 minutes of a movie, or does it have to be like an image?
No. It's whatever you want it to be. It could be a whole movie.
It won't be a whole movie, but it would be like, it probably would be like the pre-title sequence of GoldenEye or something.
Ooh, nice.
Thing to that effect that would really play. If it had to be an image for me nostalgically, it's just the Tomorrow Never Dies poster that I fell in love with Pierce Brosnan in a dinner jacket. Like that is to me like what I think of when you talk about James Bond. It's Pierce Brosnan in a tuxedo. Like that's my vision of James Bond holding a silenced gun. That is James Bond.
That's a great answer.
That's awesome.
Like just that image, you know, him standing there like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, an image is a great answer. How about you, Margo? Do you have a thought on that?
I don't, because I am well, I do, but I don't.
Your experience.
For me, I just don't have enough of a archive to dip into. That's the thing. I have such a skewed perspective on what Bond is and Bond means. I know what it means to other people, but I don't, for myself, I don't quite have that yet. The meaning hasn't gone, yeah, other than like, I love you, my husband, and I like spending time with you and I love sharing this with you. Like that's truly been the motivating factor for me. Sorry, that sounded like I like spending time with you. Sorry. but truly, genuinely, like when I think of Bond, I think of you. That's really like for me, August is
it an
like,
image of me holding a silenced
yeah,
pistol?
I mean, you know,
tuxedo?
It's like the small moments that we've like, sorry, that I like cut off your joke to be like, no, my turn to talk.
That's so beautiful. You know? That is so beautiful.
But you know, it's those small little moments where like, I mean, so we have a Moonraker poster on the landing of our stairs. It's like a big, it's like a one sheet at this point, I think. We were out at the Exchange for those on the West Coast. It's like Rasputin, but it's on the East Coast. So the thing about it is when we go in there, he takes his time and he looks at every individual used video game and this and that there is. And I just kind of wander to the back aimlessly. And I happened upon this massive Moonraker poster, and this was right around Christmas time. And he was all the way at the front. He hadn't seen it yet. And it was framed. It was perfect. It was beautiful. And I was like, like it was, you know, in The Emperor's New Groove when Kronk's like, like that's exactly what I was doing at the Exchange with that poster. And I ran up to the lady who was at the counter and I was like, my husband is here and he can't see this because it's going to be a Christmas present. She said, I got you. And she like rung me up real quick and she like hit it with me and we did a whole thing. And it was the perfect moment. And I hid it in his truck. And then you knew I had something because I'm not good at keeping secrets, but you didn't know what it was. And then there was the big reveal on Christmas time. And so that memory right there, that's Bond for me. Then there's another memory like that. And then there's another memory like that. That's what Bond is right now for me. It's the relationship with the person who's introduced it to me. And I feel like that's something that I love about my affinity for Bond, is that I get to do this with my husband and all that. So that's my one thing.
That's a beautiful thing. That is- August is going to go here, and he's not going to have an answer as good as that.
So. No,
yours is
going to
be
not.
A one-liner.
Do you expect me to talk?
He's just going to say the Nintendo 64 cartridge.
Of yeah. Like,
and you're over here saying it is a symbol of my love for my husband. And August is like, well, there was this 5-inch action figure.
No, exactly.
But it's just as
I should
valid.
Have had you it go is, last.
It's valid regardless. Yeah, because you didn't think I would have an answer. I think it's valid regardless. I think it is that's the beauty of the Bond fandom, is it's so unique per individual, but there is that what do you call it? That focal point that is James Bond that brings us all together. There's that common, what is it? Denominator? God.
Common denominator.
Thank you. Sorry. I'm like, I don't know. I feel so not very smart in this episode. I'm forgetting a lot of words, but
it's a second language.
Yeah. So I do think there's value in anything that is Bond.
Mm-hmm.
So go right ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to have a great answer.
I'll never sound as beautiful as how Margot explained her love for Bond and what would sum up what James Bond is as a character for someone fresh and new. But I'll have a quick two-part. If I am going to like do what the question was and just like sum up a scene, it would probably be that ski jump, Spy Love Me,
sure,
parachute, you know, Union British Jack. Flag,
yeah,
Union Jack. It's classic, it's British, it's Bond.
Yep.
But then beyond that, maybe I'll make it the short version. But sticking with Moonraker was Margot and I's first dance yeah. song at our wedding. So it will always be super special to us. And it's just I really can't hear that song without getting emotional anymore, because I think of our wedding day and I think of, you know, Margot and dancing with her.
I'd never seen the movie either. So
she
that
still hasn't seen
song.
It yet.
Only exists in me and August's relationship. Once again, wrapping it back to that.
Mm-hmm.
That song is my wedding song, our wedding song.
Still haven't gotten to Moonraker yet?
Mm-mm, haven't gotten to Moonraker. We got the poster, we got the song, but we haven't gotten to Moonraker yet. And even without seeing Moonraker, I really like it. I just like what it's done to my life.
Well, I love Moonraker, but I don't have that association with it. And I feel like I'm always fighting an uphill battle whenever I tell somebody that Moonraker is in my like top five. But
all right.
But I hope you do enjoy it when you see it.
I'll be on your team. I'll be in your corner and I'll be like, you know why it's great? It's because one time I went to the exchange and then that'll be all thing. And that'll be that.
Yeah. Moonraker is I don't know. I'm keeping it like special for, you know, our Good Squeeze show. Like, we'll get to it eventually. Like it's us chronicling the Bond movies. I almost want to keep it for last just because of our, you know, whole experience with Moonraker.
Yeah. I want to see the most. Every time you ask, I'm like, Moonraker. And you're like, no, not yet. I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah.
But we'll get to it eventually. My last question Ryan. My last question. Mm-hmm. You're a gentleman who enjoys fragrance.
Oh, yeah. Very much.
Scent the character. This is for fun and off the cuff. If you were to pick out a cologne for Blofeld, what would Blofeld smell like?
Oh, it depends on which version of Blofeld we're talking about a little bit, doesn't it?
It does.
I don't think Kelly Savalas is wearing the same thing as Charles Gray's Blofeld from Diamonds Are Forever.
Certainly but, not.
Can it be the one who gets kicked into a chimney?
Yeah, the one from For Your Eyes Only.
Yeah. The delicatessen and stainless steel guy. Yeah. No, we'll just go with like the most iconic Blofeld, Dr. Evil Blofeld from You Only Live Twice. He really liked to decorate his office in like a lot of medieval stuff. It's a volcano lair, and he's like, let me get a bunch of like medieval Renaissance furniture and like vibe it out that way. So I feel like it's got to be really like weirdly ornate. It's going to be like a really like weirdly fussy fragrance. And he does like just have a cat. So he's kind of like, he's kind of performative anyway, right? He's just always carrying a fluffy white pretty cat around with him everywhere he goes. I think there is a fragrance by Guerlain called Mitsuko that is a classic of the genre. It's kind of a peachy, ambery, floral thing, but it's also very dark. It's also very grand. I think Donald Pleasence's Blofeld might have worn vintage Mitsuko.
Excellent. Love that you had a very quick analysis of what Blofeld would wear, but also I love that you were on our show today. Thank you so much, Ryan, for being on A Good Squeeze, for taking the time and chatting with us, you know, through the lens of the analyst, like Bond, through the years, I guess.
The most thoughtful answers, just so eloquent, so well-spoken. It was just a delight hearing you answer. I mean, I just wanted you to keep talking the entire time, despite me interrupting all the time. I swear that's how I felt.
No. I love chatting with you guys. The pleasure is really all mine. Thank you for having me. And it's been a delight.
Thank you so much. The pleasure was all ours. And truly, I mean, it was wonderful meeting Mackenzie. Delightful. Cannot wait to see her in person. And just being able to talk to you, pick your brain, blessing us with your I'm stuttering because you're so good at talking. I'm like, oh, you were talk good. And I'm like, I'm just overwhelmed by.
See, that's why he's the Fraser Crane and we're the Martin Crane of the Bond community. Yeah. We're that duct tape chair.
We're bulldog.
I stumble a lot. I just edit those sections out of my videos these days. I don't know. I don't necessarily feel as articulate as you find me to be, but thank you.
We will not have to do any editing. That was absolutely wonderful. So thank you so much for gracing us, gracing our listeners who already know you, but still, you know, it's nice to get a little extra analyze this in there.
As a thank you for being on our show, I would like to honor analyze this Mr. Bond by curating a cocktail. If with your blessing, would you be okay with that?
You have more than my blessing. You have my gratitude and thanks. Yes, 1,000 times yes. Anyone who follows me on Instagram knows how much I love cocktails. I have loved watching you two create cocktails. You guys are doing cocktail content like pros. Yes, my jaw drops every time you drop a new cocktail.
All the credit for curating the cocktail goes to him. Here's the bartender, the alchemist.
The alchemist.
I just know how to hold the phone. And
there's your new nickname, the alchemist and the novice. There you go.
We've graduated.
The alchemist and the cinematographer. The
cinematographer, yeah.
I'm drinking the Analyze This Mr. Bond cocktail tonight, and it's a winner, if I do say so myself, but maybe you'll try and be like back to formula. But yes, thank you, Ryan, for being on the show, and I look forward to talking with you in the future.
Yeah,
I'm sure it won't be long before we chat again. Thank you again, both of you. It's been lovely.
And if you wouldn't mind putting out your plugs, where people can find you. I know they know where to find you, but if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, I mean, if you Google Analyze This Mr. Bond, there aren't a lot of people out there using the Analyze This Mr. Bond moniker, but I'm on Instagram primarily, and then I also do some YouTube stuff, both under Analyze This Mr. Bond, and then I have a Substack called The Vagabond Dossier. If you find me on Instagram, it's linked there. You can very easily get to it. And those three places are generally where I haunt the internet.
Nice. Haunt the internet. Very cool. We haunt the internet on Instagram and Instagram only. At a good squeeze.
That's where you can see us putting, us squeezing Bond, squeezing the life out of stuff until it becomes James Bond.
That's right. Such as cocktails.
Yeah, that's right. And as far as podcasts go, hey, you can hear us wherever you're listening to us now. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, Audio Boom. If you want to listen on the URL, wherever you get your podcasts, we're there.
That's right. And on that note, I'm Margo.
I'm August.
And who are you?
Who are you?
I don't know. No, I'm Ryan.
And this has been
a good squeeze. Would you like to do the good squeeze in a Pierce Brosnan voice?
Oh, I can't do it. The Irish Brosnan accent. Good squeeze. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe that was okay? I don't know.
That was brilliant. That was beautiful. It was a thing of beauty.